today we're here with Dr. Gary Goldstein, who runs the Kennedy Krieger Institute. Gary, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Can you maybe, before we start talking about your work, just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, from the career perspective, I'm a child neurologist and have been doing this for many decades. And for the last 20-some years, I've been the director of the Kennedy Krieger Institute, which is a full-service training and care and educational program focused on individuals with developmental disabilities broadly and their families and the community. And we have a biomedical approach, an educational approach. We do biomedical and other kinds of research, and we train lots of professionals, physicians, psychologists, therapists of many kinds, and one of the major training programs in the country, the leadership training programs of helping people go out throughout the country and actually throughout the world and in the field of developmental disabilities broadly, whether it's physical, behavioral, intellectual.
And you're also involved with Autism Speaks.
I am. One of the disabilities I became interested in here, I'm not a personal expert, is in autism. And my own investigations revealed that the amount of private support philanthropy for autism at the time was much, much smaller than for other significant pediatric disorders or developmental, not developmental, but pediatric disorders. I made a study of this and saw that the few foundations that were out there trying to get to the causes and treatments of autism had resources that were much, much smaller than comparable organizations that were making more progress. So I actually was involved in helping think through and launch Autism Speaks.
Oh, okay. And it sounds like you maybe wear some other hats as well. You're a busy guy.
Well, yes. The Institute and my own interests are broader than autism. So we have, you know, historically cerebral palsy was the condition we were working with, and then traumatic brain injuries and traumatic spinal cord injuries. So on the physical end, lots of people who have physical disability. And then significant behavioral and learning problems, attention deficit learning disability. And autism is actually a sort of a late comer for us. It's been the last probably 10 years that we have really built up our autism program at the Institute. It's about 20% of what we do now.
Right, okay. Do you want to maybe tell us then a little bit about what kind of autism work you do at the Institute?
So it's broad. Rebecca Landa is the leader of our autism center. She's well known for her launching the concept of monitoring the siblings of the newborn siblings of children born into a family where there is already a child with autism, and watching their development. And this has become the Baby Sits Project. It has a consortium. I think there are 15 groups around the country now doing this. And the idea is, knowing that autism has a significant heritable component, that these children, these newborn children, would probably be at higher risk than the general population. And by watching them develop, she could see the earliest signs of autism and then confirm later, as it evolved, that the child actually had autism. So a big emphasis here has been on early recognition and then early and very early intervention. So a lot of what she does centers on how early can you decide someone is at high risk for autism, and what do you do about it? And how do you alert pediatricians to the fact that this can be recognized, certainly in most cases, by the age of two?
Is she the one that did the study that was the video of people doing various actions on one side of the screen with geometric shapes on the other side of the screen and then following the gaze patterns of babies?
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of people doing that sort of thing. I'm not sure the one you're talking about, but theirs is a pretty comprehensive age-appropriate exam. So they begin to see these babies I think it's 6 weeks, 3 months, you know, 6 months, 9 months, and so forth, and videotape their examinations. And then later on can look, you know, and they track these children. They used to be all the way out to age six, and then a certain percent would, you know, have autism by the classic characteristics, and another percent wouldn't. And you could look back at those videotapes blindly and see if you could recognize the group that was going to go on to develop autism by their postures, by how they, what kind of repetitive activities they were doing, and so forth. So I'm not the expert on this. He's a good one to talk to. But what evolved was that you could really, in at least classic autism, recognize about half the babies as being at very high risk by the age of 12 months. And the other half, almost the other half, by 2 years of age. And then this is in conjunction with knowing that at that time, we're going back 8-10 years, the families we were seeing with children with autism, even though they may have had blatant evidence of the disorder to us, and maybe to the parents, they weren't being diagnosed by the medical system. And that was a common theme and a common complaint to the parents we would see that, gee, I went to my doctor, I explained he wasn't interacting, this wasn't happening, that wasn't happening, and I was told, come back in 6 months and let's see, you know, just don't worry, this is not a deviation to normal development. So this was a common theme. She did her work, and I think the whole world has changed since then of, you know, pediatricians, in addition to monitoring your growth and whatever, are also looking to see whether your social interactions and other behavioral things that might be indications of autism. So I think the work's been central to that. And what's important about recognizing it early, it really wouldn't matter if you didn't have something to do. But there are behavioral interventions that really, and now have been proven in double, you know, in controlled studies, that really alter the severity and the presence of autism if you begin them in these early times. The studies aren't really before 2, but you know, between 2 and 4 or something like that. So I think one big area of what we do.
My mother, we've been trying to think back, you know, 39 years ago, which is how old I am, and my mother said the other day when I was back in Australia that when I was a baby, I didn't like being held very much, and that's the only sign that she can really think of. Is that typical?
That's a typical one. There are sensory things, so you can just, there's a structured examination, not like a classic neurologic examination of reflexes and things, but behavioral of how the baby has joint attention with the parent, how the baby likes being held, and how they react to other people around them. And these observations are made, with different approaches for a 9-month-old and for a 3-month-old. And those were the things that people picked up on. And, of course, if you were to go to a pediatrician and say that 10 years ago, you know, they'd say, well, you know, babies are different and nothing to worry about as long as your growth, your height and weight and other things were okay. But now I think many more people are alerted to worry about, is this on the autism spectrum? So I think that's been one, I think, very important contribution here has been her work in that area. But that's not all we do.
I know, we'll talk about the other stuff. It's obviously, you know, special interest and all that, right, which is what I'm fascinated by. But, yeah, we will do that. But so I'm just curious then. So today, if a baby was born like I was that didn't like being held very much, you mentioned some of the interventions that you've got that work well. What kind of interventions would you do?
So these are repetitive desensitization almost, I mean, where you would not just accept that a baby isn't making eye contact with you or in more subtle ways, not looking and engaging other people in the room. It's very interesting watching these videos of the young children, and I didn't, you know, really realize this as a pediatrician myself, but when you, you know, engage a baby with a new object, the child who might have autism is equally interested in it as the other baby without autism. But what they don't do is try to visually, this is before language, try to visually share the experience with their mother. So you watch these videos, and you hand the baby something new, or you put something in front of them that's interesting, and they immediately see it, become interested, and then almost instantaneously look over at their mother, it's almost to say, but they're not saying it with their eyes, look at this. I'm excited, you're excited, let's do this as a team. Where the baby that is at risk gets engaged with the object and ignores that there are other people in the room or their mother is in the room. And so these very subtle, but they're not so subtle when you watch the videos. And you might not even appreciate this if you were in the room because so much is going on. So I think what's been very important has been that all these examinations are taped. And then you can go back and slowly watch, does this baby ever look over? How often does the baby look over to engage their mother in the game, in the toy that they're... that's just one example. That's shared attention. Oh, and then what do you do to treat that? So you reward them. Every time they glance over, even though it's not, you know, at a normal rate, you become very excited and you reward them. How do you reward them? You might blow bubbles. You could do lots of things. That's the beginning. I watch them do therapy in very small groups with toddlers. And one of the games they play is there's four children sitting there, all of whom have autism. They're all sort of in their own world of being engaged with therapists. And the game to play is you give them a picture of one of the other children who's sitting there next to them, one of the other three or four children. And when they, you know, when they finally look at that picture and then they give it to the child whose picture it is, everyone gets excited and there's all this, you know, hoopla about it. And you keep doing this every day, and all of a sudden you see these kids begin to engage as a group and begin to be more social. So I think it's normal interactions, but you instead of just coming easily to these children, you have to really work on it, and you have to keep track of what you're trying to do. And if you really wanted to see this, or you really have to talk to Becky, because she's sort of an expert in doing this. But she's not alone now. I mean, this is what early intervention's about. There's nothing harmful about it, in that a child who doesn't have these traits quickly does these things, and there'd be no reason to be in these programs, but it wouldn't hurt them to be, you know, playing a game where they're looking at a picture and seeing who in the room that is. But to get a child with autism to do that early and repeatedly takes a lot of work. But all of a sudden, it begins to happen.
It sounds really exciting, and it sounds to me like, from the research I've done, it absolutely makes sense.
And it makes a difference. Really, but the idea is, it isn't just that baby now looks more like what we consider to be normal or not with autism, but when you watch that child develop, they're on a different track than they would have been without having had this therapy. And let me tell you, this doesn't take like 15 minutes. This is hours per week. So the challenge of this is it's labor-intensive and it's expensive because some people do this one-on-one. We like doing it both one-on-one and in small groups because we like to see the children get social with each other. But it's a small group. It's trained people, and you're spending, you know, 3 hours a day doing this every day or whatever the schedule is. It's costly.
Can most kids get through it, or do they...
Yes. Oh, well, it varies. This is not like a cure. So I think some children who you look like for the world, they're heading toward autism, and we would have seen that happen, really do seem to take a totally different track. It doesn't mean they're going to be salesmen when they grow up, but they're not going to have this. So some are very okay. Others, I think, are better than they would have been without it. You know, autism is so complicated because it comes with... is there going to be intellectual disability associated with the autism? We used to think it always was there. When I was 30 years ago, we thought at least 75% of children with autism had significant mental retardation or intellectual disability. IQs less than 70. We don't think that anymore, not because of the early intervention, but because of the recognition that autism is a set of traits, and it doesn't include mental retardation, but it's associated with it much more than in a population without autism. We're not fixing mental retardation by doing this early intervention.
Right. But you would say that, and I mean, this is, you know, Unfortunately, I guess it's tough to talk about, but it does sound like you're in some cases, you're fixing autism.
Yes, I really think so. And what's come with, the early advocates saw these changes, but people, the doubters would say, yeah, but how did you know what was really going to happen? But now there have actually been controlled studies of groups that are on the waiting list or who are, however they've done this in an ethical way, but the outcomes are different for children who have the intensive early intervention. And the beauty of this is, or maybe it isn't a beauty, but there's not a drug that does this. It's like we're putting these children on some psychiatric medication and then they get better. This is just intensive. The people are well trained if you're going to a daycare center, these would be the daycare people. They don't have 20 kids, they have 4. And they're really trained in the scripts of what to do with them and to be responsive to how the child changes. And this is going on all over the country, it's everywhere. And I think it's going to make a big difference. Now, how many children get to this? I don't know the percentages in each community. It's still hard to find trained people. It's hard to get reimbursed to do this. But that's a whole story in itself. I think this is probably the most important advance that's happened because we don't yet have a pharmacology for autism. There are psychiatric drugs that help with some of the psychiatric comorbidities that some people with autism have. So if you have autism and depression or autism and some aggressive behavior, there are medications that will help with that aspect of it. But there aren't medications that get to the core of autism, the socialization issues and the secondary language issues and the repetitive behaviors of autism.
Would we want drugs to treat it?
I don't know that. I think if it's disabling, to me, the traits of autism for some people are the source of their success. They're able, and if you accept this, that there's an ability to focus better than other people and a stick-to-itiveness that sometimes can be difficult to deal with people, but they won't get off the track. They believe something or they want to accomplish something and they just won't stop. Now,
like having an interview with a guy who wants to talk about autism when we need to talk about the rest of your institute as well.
Exactly. And they won't get off the track. But that makes them successful. But if the track they're on is looking at a piece of string all day long and they don't want to get off that track, that's a bad track to be on. I think we all would agree on that. So what you want to do, you're so focused, you're expressing it by wanting to sit in a rocking chair and look at string all day long. That's not good.
Hmm.
If you're so focused that you can see patterns in stock prices and use the computers and become a multi-billionaire because you're a stock trader, is that good or bad? I don't know. But I think this trait gives you, I think, some really unusual abilities. But to the extreme, it gives you disability. That's my own personal view of this, because I think when we begin to keep expanding the diagnosis of who has it, then you begin to see people who have these traits, but they actually use them to their success.
Right.
And there are people who have it, and who maybe because they also have an associated intellectual disability or whatever happened, but they're stuck. And by all contemporary criteria, they're dependent. So I guess you're not successful. If you can't go out and take care of yourself because you're sitting there rocking and looking and wanting to hear the same song over and over and over and over and over again.
Or watch Thomas the Tank Engine 300 times over.
Exactly. But you can do that if you can go out and still do more things. And you don't have to be a salesman. I think it's very hard for people with autism, I think, to be successful in public relations and sales, but they can be very successful in the back room making things work.
Hmm.
I think. Now, I don't think those people have a disease. I think that these are some of the traits that are part of what we call autism. I don't think it's a disability until you're not able to take care of yourself. We have that extreme.
And,
I mean, we have children who are, you know, in our self-injury treatment program who have autism, who are nonverbal, who are 10 years old, and the way they communicate is by banging their head on the wall.
Right.
That's not very good. And that's very different than people who, you know, are hedge fund people.
There's a book that Simon Baron Cohen recommended called Joe, the Only Boy in the World. I don't know if you've read that.
I haven't read it.
It's by a guy in the UK talking about his son who's started off nonverbal and gradually became somewhat verbal, but not really. And it's the boy Joe wasn't able to understand about cars, and so he'd run out into the middle of the road, and you know he got hit by a car once, and he got hit by the car and bounced off and got up and kept. They have a tough life, I think.
Yes. I mean, I've been at these meetings of advocacy groups where, you know, there's someone who might be like you at the table saying, and not that you're going to say this, but saying, this is not really a disease. I don't know why we're making such a fuss about it. And this guy's talking, and he could write a book, and he's intelligent, and he's got a life. Maybe he's introverted. And then a mother is on the other side and said, I don't know what you're talking about. My child can't talk. He's 10 years old. He's totally dependent. He's rocking all day long. What do you mean we don't need to be doing something and discovering the causes and treatments of this thing? So there is that division because of this incredibly broad spectrum that we're saying. You know, did you see the study in South Korea where they went through classrooms looking at children not who had been picked out as having a problem, but just
they looked at everybody.
Every child in the classroom.
Yeah.
They say one boy in 30 has autism.
Right.
And none of those had been recognized by their teachers. Not that the teachers were, I mean, none of them were having problems that stood out enough to get attention. But when they sat down and did the ADOS, whatever else they did, they found they scored in the autism range.
Well, I mean, what do you think is going on in the tech sector? I mean, you know, a lot of us are...
And that's why I say these traits can make you very successful.
Hmm.
And we want to have computer programmers, and we want to have people who can do that. And we have them, and we're not going to treat them. I mean, you don't want to prevent that. So it's complicated. But you've got to come see, you know, we have a school, we have a special education school in different sites, but here in Maryland, it's the Kennedy Krieger Schools, and we have about 600 day students. These are children from elementary through high school. And in that school, we have about 50 children of 300 with autism that don't have language. And they're profoundly affected. And they're never, I mean, we're helping them behave better and get on better, but they're never going to be, they're going to be dependent on their parents and society forever.
Right.
And yet we have others. You know, I met a boy who's, you know, he left our high school after he graduated. He's now at the University of Maryland, and he's finished all the college all the college math courses in his first year of college, and he's now taking graduate math courses. He's a little unusual in his affect. He's begun to like talking to people. I mean, groups. He gave a lecture to our board. You know, so he has autism. He looks a little unusual, but he's not. And he says he wants to. I forgot what his career goals were, but. You know, he's going to get a PhD in math. He'll probably get it before he's 21. You know, and he's very smart. And he's become more and more verbal. And what we did for him, when he came, he couldn't go to school. He had such social anxiety that he could not be in school. He just was at home all the time playing with puzzles. And no one even knew how smart he was. And the school system, he was just at home all the time. And finally, you know, there's a whole system to get to our school. So he's in the school, and you know, for the first year or two, the whole thing was to get him to be social enough to participate in the classroom setting and to interact a little bit. And what we did for him, we didn't make him as smart as he was. He came there. When he was sitting at home doing these puzzles, he already had all the abilities, talent. But he was so affected by the autism that he did not interact to the point where he was unsuccessful. He graduated, And I think what we did for him was socialization. We didn't make him as smart as he is, and now he can do it. And he said, well, you know, I have friends. They're in the chess club and the physics club and the math club. Those are my friends. You know, he's explaining this to our board.
Right.
You know, and so be it. And he's,
yeah.
You know, I think we've done a wonderful thing for him, getting him to be able to go to that school socially and not have such social anxiety, and to find his friends in the chess club.
That is a great thing. But this brings also a really interesting point. It's something that I've struggled with trying to understand as well. Autism obviously comes with some issues, but it does come with some benefits. Now, the benefits come from, you know, intense focus on work and things like that. However, I have a kind of an odd creative intelligence that, I don't know, like, it's actually a little bit like, I don't know, have you seen any of the Harry Potter series?
Yes.
The girl on Harry Potter, who Tony Atwood feels that J.K. Rowling may even be on the spectrum, but Hermione Granger, she's sort of the very studious one, but she even actually talks about on the last movie where she talks about finding little details that other people missed and then being able to connect pieces together.
Yes,
I have
that's
that.
Like doing the puzzle. You know, if you give a 1,000-piece puzzle to a 4-year-old, what are they going to do with it? But what about a child who can actually see the patterns? And it's not just something bizarre, because they're also normal intelligence, and put this thing together. And that's focus, but it isn't just focus. I mean, I could spend all day totally focused on this, and I couldn't do it, you know, and they can do it. So,
no, when I used to play puzzles with my grandmother when I was a kid, she would I'd always beat her, and what I found out years later, the way she would cheat is she'd watch where I was looking and then use that to
right.
figure out.
So the brain is wired differently, I think, and it can be to an advantage, or it can be to a disadvantage if it ends up being chaotic. And I think one of the serious problems is the effect on social interaction. To the point of, you know, it isn't aloofness. I think some people thought, well, maybe these people are introverted and happy this way. But I think what we're finding is they're not happy not being social. And I think there's social anxiety, and I think there's a desire to be interactive with family and have friends. And it depends how extreme that is. And if it gets to a point where you can't participate in society, that's incredibly disabling, or if you're anxious all the time because of it. And I think that's a serious part of autism. And then there's the focus, and I think it's like you keep dialing it up, and if you get to the point where maybe it's string theory or something, but you're looking at that string, and maybe you see things that are incredibly creative there, but you can't do anything with it, you suddenly are not productive.
Simon Baron-Cohen talks about the concepts of cognitive empathy and affective empathy. he put an interesting box in one of his books where he marks affective empathy as missing on the low end of the autism spectrum, and he previously marked it as missing on the high end of the autism spectrum as well. And affective empathy meaning, I guess, more or less feelings for other people. And so that kind of annoyed the those on the high end of the autism spectrum, saying, no, we have feelings and so on as well. What you're saying would tend to fall in my direction, which is agreeing with what the others on the spectrum are saying.
Yes, I think they can look that way. So I think if you observe from the outside, you can say, here's someone who doesn't care and is not interested, and it doesn't bother them, and they're happy in their own world. But that's you, that's me, as a casual observer looking at the behavior of somebody. It's not me on the inside not wanting to be able to do things that they just can't do, or it's very hard for them to do. And I think what I'm learning, and I'm not an expert like these people. I mean, I'm really I am a director of an institute, and I am encouraging different people in our different groups to be productive and creative with the problems they're working on. But I'm not there examining the patients or doing the MRI scans or looking at the gene arrays and things. Those are other people here. So I'm not
right.
an autism expert. I am a child neurologist, a director of an institute interested in promoting the different groups that can impact these disabilities. I am particularly fascinated by autism because it's more of a mystery to me. I'm not going to solve it, but more of a mystery to me than paralysis is. I mean, I have a better understanding. I don't know how to treat paralysis, whether it's muscular dystrophy or a stroke or cerebral palsy, but I understand mechanistically how the brain or the muscle system can dysfunction can lead to paralysis. I sort of understand what's going on. I see the disability. I understand how you need better wheelchairs and how you, if we could prevent these or treat these. I can't fix it. It's a great challenge, but it's understandable. Hmm. Cancer is a little less understandable, but I still get it. Autism is much more mysterious to me because it gets to the things that are human, that make us human, where you can have a cat that's paralyzed or a rat that's paralyzed. This is this is much more of the human condition, and so it's a much more sophisticated issue. And so I find it fascinating. It's also very difficult to get your hands around it. That's why we're having this conversation, where if we're just talking about, not just, but if we're talking about somebody who had a spinal cord injury, even if you know anything about this, I could explain to you pretty quickly why, when your spinal cord is disconnected from your brain, why you can't move your legs. You know, and what can you do about it? And it gets to be cell biology and connections and myelin and stuff like that. And it's not mysterious. It's just very, very difficult to fix it. Here, I don't even know what... This is so much more complicated. It's all about what being human is. It's beyond what the motor system and other things. So that's why I'm interested in it. But I'm not solving anything. I'm at a level... You know, I just try to recruit people and have them be productive. And then I also had this feeling that we ought to be raising a lot more money to advocate and do things for autism. And when I look to see that, muscular dystrophy, the one association raises $100, $200 million a year. St. Jude's Hospital for Children with Cancer raises $300 million a year for children with cancer, which is wonderful. They get the money and they can do that. And here was autism, more common than all of these problems. Severe autism being more common than all of these disorders, and raising $5 to $10 million a year, it wasn't enough to get anywhere. So I saw that, and I just said, hey, there ought to be a foundation that's raising more money.
And, it's great that you teamed up with the rights and did that. And it's surprising to me that this hasn't become much of an issue in the tech world because, there's a lot of us that have it. It's an interesting thought to me. I spent a half a day with a child in the Caribbean with a friend of mine who's a doctor down there who's on the low end of the spectrum. He's nonverbal. He's kept medicated all day long. One of the interesting things that they showed me is he was in a bedroom. There was some chairs and tables in a room that he had to walk through, and they would move some of the chairs around, like put a chair on top of a table so it was disorganized, and then call him, and we were in another room. The boy would come out of his room, walk past, he'd see that some chairs were out of place, and then arrange them properly and then come over to it. And it was very clear and very repetitive, the systematization, which I think is a very strong drive in the tech world. It would seem to me, with the work that you're doing on babies...
That's a classic situation, sameness. Just, you go into a room and some little thing has changed. But it's almost like on the OCD, the obsessive compulsive kind of traits. There are people who have nothing with autism, but they can't stand when I have a sister-in-law like this, and I deliberately, twist one of her something on a table there, and she comes in and sees it immediately. She knows what I'm doing and puts it back so it's squared to the table and it's centered just perfectly. And it upsets her if it's not. But she doesn't have autism, I don't think. but she certainly has that she wants everything in her house just where it's supposed to be, and she can pick up in an instant when it's to move.
Yeah.
Some of us have pretty sloppy rooms.
I just came back from Australia and my apartment was a big mess because they'd put in a new floor, and so that was actually quite stressful for me. I had to rearrange everything.
Then it leads to most, whatever. Yeah, so it's, This is a very... So why would that be, you know?
Well, no, so where I'm going with this point is, I think the systematizing drive is strong in the tech sector. If, with the work you're doing on babies, you're able to reduce the social issues, then we may have a group of very well socially calibrated people who have a very strong systematizing drive that can do great stuff.
And you're not trying to change that. And in fact, you're not working on that. So I think that the main core symptom that people want to work on is this socialization. And at the baby level, it just doesn't seem good not to engage your family in your... And the children look so happy after this change. It's like such a spontaneous thing in children without autism that right from the get-go, that they want to engage their family in whatever they're discovering as they get bigger, as they develop. And I think the mistaken thought is that the children with autism don't want to. They're not doing it, but it isn't that they don't want to. And I think when we help them do it by rewarding them continuously when they do it, I think this leads to happiness. I think this is a happier situation. And I think if we can get to that, that's a major event.
Yeah, no, I would profoundly agree.
Yeah.
I've asked you 10,000 questions about autism. We should talk about other things. Do you want to tell us about other aspects of the Institute and maybe what you think is going on, not more on a policy level, and what you see from your pretty unique standpoint?
Well, in the autism community, like even, I don't want to get anything negative, but it is sort of, in other countries, developing countries, when we go talk about autism, they want to include the other developmental disorders, whether they're physical or intellectual or learning disability. We're here, I think we have the luxury of saying, we're only advocating for autism. We're not advocating for children, or adults with mental retardation, for example, and things like housing and job opportunities and job coaching and whatever. So I think the other big issue that everyone is now focusing on is... What kind of help do adults need who have autism? And of course, it varies with where they are in severity on with their other symptoms. So for me, I have the broader view that for this institute to contribute, we look at the child's brain and the developing brain throughout development, actually, and maybe in some genetic or environmental way, these vulnerabilities and exposures might be autism, but they might end up being attention deficits, or they might end up being a learning disability. And some of those children have autism, but those other problems, some don't. And we're not, we certainly understand the differences and needs of the different populations, but we're looking at the disorders of the developing brain as they get expressed. And the same lesion in the motor system may lead you to paralysis, and if it's more, in the temporal lobe or further front in the frontal lobe, it's going to be socialization issues. So a lot of our work has to do with the ability of the whole concept of plasticity and the idea that neurons can make new connections continuously through life, and the insights we get from children who are paralyzed in the brain from children who have autism, those are overlapping contributions. So we're not mixing everybody together, but we sort of see the challenge. The same genes, when you look at these genes that are being identified as having some risk for autism, most of them don't cause it, but you see them having risk for other conditions that we see. So how does it get not only is there an autism spectrum, there's a developmental disability spectrum that doesn't include autism, but includes learning disability and attentional problems and behavioral problems.
Right.
But I think we get the broader view because we're not an autism center. We're a developmental disability center, and all comers. And we're very interested in the tools then, the tools of modern imaging. We have an incredible imaging center here. Research imaging center using MRI to look not only how the brain looks but how it works. And we have a genomic center looking at, and we're just beginning to have these tools of being able to look at someone's entire genome. And we're beginning to look at conditions, not necessarily autism to start with, but other disorders that are much easier to make the clinical diagnosis. And I think that helps us look at all the children, including the ones with autism.
For those interested in funding research, I've looked at a lot of autism research, and I mean, where I sit, I don't like the idea of pills. I very much like the idea of the behavioral stuff that you're talking about, because it seems like to me like that is going to be the right approach to solving it. And it also seems to me like that is an area that is not funded very much. There's no, if you come up with, you know, some unique behavioral type therapy, there's no patent protection, copyright protection, trademark protection. It's basically
very
out there.
Very hard to do that. That's right. Very hard
and
to
so,
do that.
And without any real protection around it, I think it's not really being funded. So my feeling is that we're maybe overfunding pills just because it's a business, and the behavioral stuff is being underfunded, and that's where the research should be going. And I'm curious as to your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, there has been. If you look, you have to sort of pull the grants and see what's been funded. I did that earlier when I first began, working with the nascent Autism Speaks. I began to do not just literature searches, but NIH searches of just what was being funded by the NIH, what was being funded by the then other foundations, and where were the gaps, So the Baby SIBS Network has received good funding, but not at the level like the genomic studies. And I think the challenge right now with the behavioral studies is dissemination. I think if you come to Kennedy Krieger or go to 50 other places in this country, there is some really good behavioral intervention available. But when you add it all up, how many children can all of these 50 centers serve, if there are 50? And then you look at the fact that it's 1% of all children, you know, so there's 40,000 children every year being added to this collection. There are not 40,000 slots out there. There's at most 10%. So how do we get from being able to serve 10% to 90% to 100%? And how do we disseminate it? How do we make it more cost-effective? How do we do this? And I think that's what I think we actually have something we can help with, but we're not applying it to as many children as needed. Now, one approach has been and this has been an Autism Speaks agenda, to get states to pass laws to pay for this stuff. And they've been marching around the country, state legislators, getting laws changed. But you have to have someone on the other end to do it. And the law itself doesn't always translate into funding, even though the law says it should be funded. We're at that point. We have something to disseminate, and I don't know that it's research money, but it's dissemination money. And maybe it's too expensive what we're doing, and there's a better... Just because what we do works to the degree it does, doesn't mean it couldn't be done more more cost-effectively.
It can be pretty easily. I mean, I worked at Oracle out in Silicon Valley, I worked with Sal Khan, who's doing Khan Academy now, that's being funded by Bill Gates and a bunch of others, online YouTube videos for free. I mean, you could make a whole series of training videos taking people through your training and just put it on the web. And
exactly. But then how do you get that to the child? And so at scale, I mean, you can demonstrate these things, but every year, like I say, there's 40,000 more. It isn't 4,000 more. If this were like muscular dystrophy and we had something, the challenge would be a lot different because it's many fewer cases. And cancer, I mean, we think of, you know, it's one in 4 in 100,000 children have cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's terrible for a child to have cancer, but it's 4 in 100,000. Here we're talking 1 in 100.
Mm.
Or whatever the number is, but it's enormous. So how do you get to scale for this, recognizing them? And it's not just a question of children in poverty not getting it. This is everybody. So I think that's a challenge. And we're thinking about how to do that. Some of it's reimbursement related and whatever. So I think that's one thing. And then the other is really, I think it is worth understanding the important to understand the genetic basis of this, and to understand the bigger challenge, actually. I mean, because we have the, whatever tools we have in genetics are being applied to this population.
So why do we need to understand the genetics of it?
I think we do because we might find, if this was for early recognition, for diagnosis, it's very expensive to do a two-hour ADOS or whatever to make a diagnosis. Who gets to even get that to happen to them? And you know, you have diabetes, you get a blood test and your blood sugar is 130 or something, you've got it. And it takes 5 minutes and $100. We've got a much more complicated way to make the diagnosis now. So even that would make a difference. If you knew which children were at high risk, you would begin these early interventions. I mean, we know the babies, siblings are at high risk. But what about the other children? How do you know who you should start this with? The earlier, the better. I mean, I think if you could start at 6 months, it might be much more cost-effective to do that. But who would you do it to? So I think if we had a handle on, you know, most of the genetics and cancer and stuff has led to diagnostic tools, not to treatments. So I think diagnosis would be an important reason for that. And then I think it also would help you hone in on what are the environmental triggers that may be more important than the genetics, but that they link up together with the genetics. So if you could study this and you knew... You could make better sense of the data if you could, in exploring and in searching for environmental triggers, if you had some homogeneity to the genetic propensity.
So let me ask you really quick on two of the hot button issues, on vaccines and gluten-free and casein-free diets. Where do you sit on those?
Yeah, it'd be nice if those were the answers, but it just hasn't been. I'm not going to get into the controversies and discuss. The parents who believe this really, really believe it. Mm-hmm. And they're not to be persuaded otherwise. And I respect their observations and their belief. On the other hand, the science just isn't holding that up. And it's not a conspiracy. It's like looking... I think what the science is saying, there is significant, maybe even more important than genetics, is the environment. But what is it? I don't think you can just pick on one exposure out of the 40,000 possible exposures out there. And you might hit a home run. I mean, if it was thimerosal, and if that was the reason, if you look back at the earlier advocacy on this, the implication was that 95% of autism was due to thimerosal. If that were the case, that would have been wonderful. Because, you know, you take it out, and 95% would go away.
There was a quote from you saying the same thing about aspirin with some other condition
as well. With Reye syndrome. Mm. You know, this is a horrible... I was really active with this, you know, and I didn't think of the connection. But the epidemiology showed that the risk of getting Reye syndrome was so much higher if you had aspirin. Of course you had aspirin. You had the flu, you had a fever, you got aspirin. But not everybody got aspirin. And it's almost only the ones that got aspirin got Reye syndrome. Take the aspirin away from children who have a fever and have the flu or chickenpox, and we haven't had a case of Reye syndrome, I can't remember. It would have been wonderful. I mean, it could have been, but it didn't have to be. We would have given up on it. If someone said maybe it's aspirin and Reye syndrome, and you did study after study and it didn't show it, you'd move on.
Right.
Well, you know, it's hard to move on in here.
Yeah.
I think the thimerosal is over. I don't want to say, I mean, we have some people who... Now, to say, well, maybe it's causing 1%, well, it's hard to prove that. But the claim was it was 90% or 95%. We know that's not the case now.
Yeah.
And let's move on. But it's something. I don't know what it is. And I don't even want to get into the vaccines because it's so emotional to people who believe it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if it were the answer, it would be... It would be done. But it's something, or it's some combination of things. And that's really hard. It's particularly hard because when you look at this whole spectrum, I mean, should you be looking for environmental exposures only in the nonverbal children? or should it be everybody? All the computer programmers? I mean, how do you even decide? You know, the epidemiology is complex. There's a great study going on. Actually, one of the first things that I was able to do when I had the ability to spend some of the Autism Speaks money was to seat an investigator, Craig Neuschafer, who's now head of epidemiology at Drexel. And he's now got a very large NIH grant to do a 10-year study, prospective study on environmental exposures in high-risk populations. But the answer won't be out for a while, but he's already 4 years into this, or 3 or 4 years into it. And I don't know if an answer will come out of that, but he's taking a look at lots and lots and lots of exposures. And vaccines will be in that list, but it'll be lots of things.
We're going to have to wrap up. Is there anything you want to mention before we do so?
No, I think this is... I think the fact that autism merges with very high-functioning people and very productive, important people to society makes this particularly challenging. I think if we were talking about an entity and it was limited to those who were nonverbal and who were dependent, and there was a sharp border, and that was it, it would make it easier to get to the essence of it. But that isn't the case.
It's a human condition. I think everybody's on the autism spectrum a very, very tiny amount.
Yeah.
Some just a little
bit more. I agree with that, and I think that's where... I think, you know, you start surveying classrooms, and you find that every classroom has at least one boy with autism, if that's the statistic. And I look back on it, and there was always somebody who was just inept socially. And sometimes they were normal, and sometimes they were very smart, and sometimes they weren't very smart. It didn't correlate with that.
Mm.
And the ones who were very smart, and they're going to do okay. If you're Bill Gates, you're going to do okay. You know, if I don't know if he was on the spectrum or not, but or Steve Jobs. These were very unusual people, but they're also brilliant.
Reading the Steve Jobs biography, I was a little bit shocked at how much of it I related to, and I noticed other people are doing the same.
Exactly. We have to be very careful monkeying with... If this was just a disorder of severely impaired people, we wouldn't be discussing whether drugs would be the way to go. Because if we could fix that with drugs, you'd want to. It's when you start moving out, you don't want to fix Steve Jobs and make him like somebody who is... wonderful and pleasant socially, but isn't a genius and didn't do what he could do.
No, this is engineering humanity. This is
So I think that's what makes this a really a challenging thing. And we spend a lot of time here thinking about what the best, how to focus our energies and using the tools that we have available to us. And all the patients, we have so many patients. So I think. We have the populations, we have the parents, what do they want to have happen? And it varies how severe the condition is, what they want to have happen. A lot of them would love a pill that would fix severe injurious behavior or nonverbal children in our classrooms. That's where I'd like to leave it.
Barry, thanks very much for your time.
Good talking to you.